L 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580, this July 19th, 2009. Today we have a longtime favorite guest of the program rejoining us, Tom Frank, the Wall Street Journal columnist and author of many great books, including The Wrecking Crew and What's the Matter with Kansas. He'll be with us for the full hour to talk about what's going on in the world of politics and journalism today, so it should be a great show. Before we get to Tom Frank, though, let's now go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. The Senate was busy with confirmation hearings this week. The hearing for Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor touched on media and technology issues when the newest senator, Al Franken of Minnesota, questioned the judge about the Internet and the First Amendment.
It plays a central role in our democracy by allowing anyone with a computer connected to the Internet to publish their ideas, their thoughts, their opinions, and reach a worldwide audience of hundreds of millions of people in seconds. This is free speech.
Franken asked Sotomayor if there was a compelling First Amendment interest in ensuring that the Internet stay open and accessible. Sotomayor called the Internet revolutionary, but answered that the court can only take up what Congress has enacted into law. Franken replied, "We've got some work to do on this."
As Sotomayor's hearing was going on, the Senate Commerce Committee held a hearing for Federal Communications Commission nominees Mignon Clyburn and Meredith Atwell Baker. Clyburn, a South Carolina utility regulator, is the daughter of House Majority Whip James Clyburn. Baker was the acting head of the National Telecommunications and Information Administration. She's the daughter-in-law of former Secretary of State James Baker. Committee Chairman Jay Rockefeller of West Virginia called the FCC one of the most important agencies in all of government. He told the nominees that the FCC was broken, and he expected them to fix it.
I think that it should rely on facts. It should accept bad news. It shouldn't be ideological. I think it has been. That's my view. I think where it should be open and transparent, it has been opaque and beholden, quite frankly, to those interests that it regulates.
Rockefeller warned that the committee would be watching the FCC very closely. The full Senate could vote on Clyburn and Baker before the August congressional recess.
And now a special guest commentary by Free Press Outreach Coordinator Mary Alice Krim.
Hispanic chick lady, an angry woman, a brown woman, this broad, demeaning, check, sexist, check, racist, check. Did these descriptions help the public evaluate Supreme Court nominee Judge Sonia Sotomayor as she faces her Senate confirmation hearing? Of course not. Yet the mainstream media have routinely spouted and parroted demeaning, sexist and racist language about Sotomayor instead of providing us with any substantive context or background about the judge. President Obama's administration said of Sotomayor, if confirmed, Sotomayor would bring more federal judicial experience to the Supreme Court than any justice in 100 years and more overall judicial experience than anyone confirmed for the court in the past 70 years. Can you imagine stooping to describe someone so qualified for a country's highest court as this broad? And yet our media have, repeatedly. Over time, our media has the ability to weave stories into our collective mindset. Racist and sexist stories can create tangled webs that cloud our minds and eventually become part of our overall understanding of the world. We rely on the media to provide us with hard-hitting information about our elected officials and the people in power so we can make informed political decisions. The media fail us all, women and men, when they don't provide substance or context in their reporting. Gender discussions have a role in politics and in the media, but that role is to foster understanding and to advance the conversation, not to push us back. In response to the media coverage of Sotomayor, the Women's Media Center released a video, Media Justice for Sotomayor, and a call to support media justice for the judge. Unfortunately, the Women's Media Center expects the mainstream media outlets will continue to produce racist and sexist coverage of Sotomayor's confirmation hearing. Over and over, I have angrily switched off my FM dial while asking myself, why does our media system persistently devalue women in positions of power in the United States? But switching off the dial and asking why isn't enough. In a world saturated with sexist portrayals of women, we cannot escape mainstream commercial media that degrade women. What we can do is stand up and say, enough. When we collectively move beyond why and into action, we can make a difference. We can create the media we want by changing the current system.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national, nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we have a live show for you, so callers will be welcome. Our guest is someone who's been on the program several times before, author of The Wrecking Crew, What's the Matter with Kansas, One Market Under God, The Conquest of Cool. I think we've had you on for all those books, except maybe Conquest of Cool, which came out before we went on the air in 2002. Our guest, of course, Tom Frank, Wall Street Journal columnist and author. Tom, welcome to Media Matters.
How are you today, Bob?
Well, I really appreciate your taking time out of your summer on a weekend to join us here at Media Matters, and our audience, I'm sure, appreciates it, too. I've been enjoying writing. You're writing for the Wall Street Journal now, and I think some people who know what you write about are probably surprised that you, of all newspapers, or you would get a job to write a column, it would be the Wall Street Journal. How did that come about?
I was the most surprised of all. It came about when they just asked me to start writing a column. You know, it was a shock, but I was excited to do it. You know, it's funny, Bob. I've wanted to be a newspaper columnist all my life. That was like my original childhood ambition.
Mm-hmm.
And everything else, you know, fell through for me. I got a PhD in history. That didn't work out. You know, it's one thing after another. And then, in the very dying days of newspapers, lo and behold, I became a columnist for the Wall Street Journal. It's an amazing thing. Although they're not a dying newspaper, but you know, these are not good times for that business.
And, yeah, we'll talk about that during the show. But, you know, what is your beat for the column, so to speak? What is your mandate that the editors gave you for the column?
Well, they didn't lay down any – I mean, what had happened is I had written – the New York Times had me do a – one of their regular columnists was on vacation in the summer of 06, I think it was. And so I filled in for whoever it was for a couple months. And the journal, the people at the journal, I think they just liked what I had done there, and so they hired me to. And they didn't say, you know, write about, you know, only write about labor or only write about domestic affairs. But I mean, you know what the kind of things I write about, you know, and that's that's what I write about for them. But they didn't lay down any hard and fast rules. But it's I'm focusing on what I'm writing about this week, which is the crazy scandal at the American Conservative Union. Have you heard this one?
I heard a little bit about it, but yeah, why don't you acquaint our listeners with it?
It's typical of what I write about generally, which are the sort of follies of conservative politics. And every now and then, Bob, I say to myself, well, you know, the conservatives are done for. They've just gotten beaten, you know, just taken to the cleaners in the last couple of elections. You know, I should write about something else. Look, Obama's doing things wrong. I should criticize the government for those things. But then there's always something crazy that happens, like, you know, Sarah Palin resigning as governor, or this week, what it is the American Conservative Union, or their specifically some of their officers. One of their officers wrote a letter to. Now this is hard to keep it straight, so I'm gonna. But take a step back. UPS. and Federal Express are fighting with each other. They both have hired lobby firms here in D.C., and they're fighting with each other over some provision that's I'm not at all clear on this, but basically one of the companies, the government wants to extend labor law that applies to one of the companies to the other company so that they're both on the sort of level playing field with regards to labor organizing. Okay, sounds straightforward enough. Well, that other company doesn't want that to happen. And so they're fighting like cats and dogs over this. And I don't remember which is which or what is what, but what happened was the American Conservative Union sent or one of their officers sent a letter to I think it's Federal Express saying we can organize this grassroots conservative campaign to make sure that your side prevails in this contest with your competitor if you give us $2 million. And one of the things that they promised was that their president, David Keene, who's a very, very respected figure here in D.C., that he would write about them in his column for a publication here in D.C., taking their side in the issue as part of this deal for $2 million. And it sounds crazy, doesn't it? And then I guess that deal didn't fell through or something. It didn't happen. And so next thing you know, David Keene is signing on to a letter written by another D.C. conservative, think tank honcho, to Federal Express, telling them they're in the wrong on this issue. So, he didn't get the money. They didn't get the money. And lo and behold, the dude switched sides. What do you know? It's this very typical kind of D.C. story. I'll get to the bottom of it. You'll see. It'll be in Wednesday's Wall Street Journal. I'll straighten it all out and get it all figured out and have it all squared away by then.
But I think the moral of the story, from what you were saying and what I've heard in other accounts of it, is that it demonstrates that maybe the principled basis of the American Conservative Union isn't especially lofty.
No, that's right. That's a good way of putting it. And that's that's very typical of these kind of organizations in Washington. This is what I wrote about in the Wrecking Crew. There's hundreds of these groups here in town. And they're putatively nonprofit groups, but they're nonpartisan, which means they don't endorse Republicans or Democrats, but they're intensely political, and they tend to act sort of like lobby groups. They they swing into action on behalf of a given company or a given industry, berating the other side of whatever it is. And the city is filled with stuff like this. And they tend to be, what's really curious about it is that they tend to be libertarian groups. They tend to be the pro-free market types. That seems to be the worst offenders.
Mm-hmm.
Washington, I don't know if you know this, Washington is filled to overflowing with libertarians. It's one of the more peculiar things about the city, because libertarians are supposed to hate big government.
Mm-hmm.
Hate government intervention in the economy, and they're all here. They all move here. Why are they? why are they here if they hate it so much?
Yeah, you think they want to be in Arkansas or someplace?
Yeah, they ought to be in Kansas, is where they ought to be.
Yeah.
But they're all here because this is where the money is. This is what the libertarians are very useful in Washington D.C. There's all these organizations dedicated to supporting them here. Because they sort of, they're the shock troops of the conservative revolution, which is now sort of knocked back on its heels a bit. But
In the Wrecking Crew, Tom Frank, this gets to the point that you made in that book, which you've written about since then, because it's such a salient point. The Republicans in power really didn't have much interest in governing that well and didn't do an especially good job of it. In fact, at times, as you demonstrate in the Wrecking Crew, they did a terrible job of it. And then they get out of power. They claim government can't do anything, so we should get rid of government.
And they use, as examples, to prove their point that government can't do anything, they use their examples of their own screw-ups.
Yeah,
what was it? There was one of these just the other day. I'm sorry, I wrote about this now 2 weeks ago, and I've already forgotten. This is how the newspaper columnist thing works. You just clear the memory banks when you finish something. But that was my subject just 2 weeks ago. Was that the conservatives, when they're trying to prove that government doesn't work, often point to their own foul-ups. I know what it was. The famous $300. What was it? Back in the 1980s, the $300 hammer or something.
The toilet
like that.
Seat in the army.
This was a conservative group was running ads talking about these things as a reason why we shouldn't have national health care because government can't do anything right. And in fact, those were famous examples of Pentagon misbehavior back in the 1980s that were unearthed by a liberal good government group. As a way of shaming the Reagan administration. And now it's being used by conservatives to tell you why you don't want government, you know.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Thomas Frank, who you've just been listening to. Tom Frank is the author of several books, including What's the Matter with Kansas, One Market Under God, and most recently, The Wrecking Crew, all of which Tom's been on the program before to talk about. He also writes a weekly column, The Tilting Yard. Is that the correct name?
That's what I call it, yeah.
The Tilting Yard for The Wall Street Journal. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment to Tom Frank, anything's fair game, I think, with today's guest. He's a newspaper columnist, after all. 333-9455, our number, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Tom, I think, your last couple of books, Wrecking Crew and What's the Matter with Kansas, have really gone into the Republican Party and the quote-unquote conservative movement, such as it is in the United States over the past couple of decades, and dissected it as well as anyone has done. And I'm wondering, as you look at the Republican Party today, having been crushed now in two consecutive elections, what does it stand for? What does conservatism mean? What does it actually stand for? And I ask this not as a rhetorical question or facetiously. I literally don't know.
Well, that's it is a good question because the traditional answer, they stand for tradition. That's what it would mean in a place like England, for the traditional way of doing things has never applied in America. I've always thought that the name conservative was a misnomer because they aren't about conserving things. In America, conservatism has always meant dedication to the principles of the market, and not even really that. It's more dedication to the needs of business, and that usually coincides with the principles of the market. But business always comes first for these guys. If free market principles get in the way, then too bad.
Mm-hmm.
But what do they stand for now? That's a good question. I think they themselves are very confused about it. It's always been, their hatred of big government is item number one on the agenda, and then of course letting business free to do its own thing, deregulate, turn off the supervision, all that sort of thing. Well, that has turned out to be a fantastic disaster.
not a real vote getter.
Yeah, and I think what will happen to them, the thing is that they can't change their spots. It's impossible because if there's one consistent thing about their history going back to the Civil War, when conservatism, as we know it, really got its start, after the Civil War, and that is the one thing that has consistently defined them is their dedication to the political needs of business. And so that's not going away. And they will, they'll stick to their language and their ideas, such as they are, until the last one of them is thrown out of Congress. They're not going to change that.
But Tom, let me. Where I'm confused about their even as a party of business, though, and I might be wrong here, and correct me if I am. My sense is that a significant percentage of wealthy and business interest have moved across the aisle over the past 5 or 10 years, and really
right.
See the Democratic Party as a much more suitable party for business than the Republican Party.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's probably it's partially opportunistic on their part. You're asking me to go to the cynical side, and I will.
Oh yeah, please.
Very very happily.
Thank you, Tom.
I found a funny description of the Democratic Party from. It was from some 19th century grouch. I forget who, but he said the ruling class sort of keeps and preserves the Democratic Party as a kind of lifeboat when they get in trouble with the other one. And I think you're seeing a little bit of that right now. they've all escaped to the Democrats. And the Democrats, look, for years they have been their sort of big thinkers in the Democratic Party have been about, you know, that's been their big idea, is we've got to move away from the sort of liberalism of Franklin Roosevelt and make ourselves an appealing pro-business party so that we can compete for the big money, you know, on an equal footing with the Republicans. And that's, you know, that strategy has borne fruit in some ways. It's been very successful. Now, and I think, you know, I like Obama. I voted for Obama. He was my state senator back in Chicago, and I was very fond of the guy. But I think that in some ways that's the route he would be taking if events had not forced his hand. I think we're living in a very a difficult time for pro-business politics. You know, it's really hard to put that message over anymore.
And Tom, what's your sense of how well? And I know you're not an economist, though I think your wife is.
She is.
That's right. And I know you study. You know, you've been a labor journalist, so you study political economy as a journalist. What is your sense of this current economic crisis? You know, you're a historian. You know, compared to other downturns, say the one in the early '90s or the early '80s. Or going back to the Depression. I mean, do you think this is another bump in the road, we're getting out of it, and we're going back to, you know, 4%, 5% unemployment and 2% growth in GDP in the next year or two?
Well, I think we probably I don't know. I can't I don't know for sure. I think that that we probably will come out of it just because we always do come out of these things eventually. I think this one is unique because, first of all, it's so severe, and second of all, because it was so clearly caused by capitalism, you know, malfunctioning, by the system being allowed to do its thing, and then its thing turns out to be, you know, crashing itself down in this really spectacular way. And it's also interesting because it's hurt the wealthy as well as the, you know, the working class with the stock market crash. So it seems in some ways like sort of a Great Depression on a smaller scale. I don't know if we have, you know, one of the big differences between now and the 1930s is that these days we don't really have the 1930s, you know, that depression came after many, many years of, you know, you had a strong and powerful left in this country, and you had a strong and powerful, you know, language of reform that someone like Franklin Roosevelt was able to speak and to talk to very easily. You know, it came naturally. And that has sort of disappeared for us now. And the race is on, if you ask me, the race is on among, you know, thinkers of all different stripes to try to claim this recession validates their own perspective. And so, you know, you have your New Economy people talking about it, and basically everybody trying to claim that the recession means that you have to do what I think is right. But to get back to your original question, how long will it last? What will happen? I just don't know the answer to that. But it is different than other recessions, because it's just been, you know, it's the causes of it are so clear, and it's so obviously the system breaking down, you know, it's total systemic screw up.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Tom Frank, you've just been listening to, author of numerous books, including The Wrecking Crew and What's the Matter with Kansas. If you'd like to call in here at WILL AM 580, our telephone number is 333-9455, our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Tom, are you working on any new books now?
You know, I'm not. The column is taking up it takes up a lot of time, and I'm also trying to revive the Baffler magazine. This is a magazine that my friends and I put out, and we're going to be bringing that back very soon.
And the Baffler is based in Chicago still?
Yes, it is. And so between those two things, I don't have time for a new book right now, but I will eventually. I'll get around to it.
You know, with regard to the Republicans that we've been talking about, I want to talk a bit more about conservatives and Republicans. You've written about Sarah Palin. And, you know, she seems like an interesting person to be almost one of the leaders of this major political party. What does it say about our country and about our politics?
That's too scary.
Yeah. What's your take on Sarah Palin and sort of the cult of Palin or the rise of Palin?
Well, it's on the one hand, she hits the notes perfectly. I've been fascinated by her since her debut at the Republican convention last year. You know, I was there and all that sort of thing. But she's fascinating to me because she does the sort of the culture war routine very, very well. Note perfect, you know. What I wrote about her last week was her the sort of her tone of victimization that she has used from day one right up until her resignation the other day, or last week, I guess, 2 weeks ago, I guess it was, this sense of her as victim, which really appeals to the base of the Republican Party. You know, they love that stuff, understanding themselves as, you know, the victims of history. This is what I'm going to take a little detour here, but this is sure. What I think people often don't understand about right-wing politics is that it's a form of protest movement. It's not a bunch of, you know, rich guys sitting in their easy chairs, you know, talking about how you have to quit bothering them and let them have higher profits. It's not that at all. It's a protest movement. You know, it presents itself as, you know, an uprising against the status quo. And Sarah Palin she has captured that tone and that sort of that way of talking very well. As for the, you know, watching her do interviews is painful. You know, when they asked her, like, what she reads, you know, oh, my God. Remember that interview during the campaign?
Yeah.
They asked her, like, about Supreme Court decisions. And then, you know, first of all, she flubbed it, you know, and didn't get the answers right. And then she claimed that they were being mean to her, that it was a trick question when they, they asked her what newspapers she read.
Well, do you think she's through now with this, you know, the sort of bizarre retirement in the midterm?
I think I think she believes that she'll be able to do well in the primaries and get the Republican nomination. But I think that's very unlikely because I don't think she could. That's a very difficult thing to do, to make your way through, you know, primary season. It goes for more than a year. You know, there's hundreds and hundreds of chances to make gaffes, and she makes gaffes all the time. I think the Republicans have I don't like to give advice to these guys, but they have a very obvious candidate, and it's Mitt Romney. I mean, I've seen this guy speak. He's really sharp. He's he's handsome. He's got a lot of money. You know, he looks like Ronald Reagan, for God's sakes. He talks like Ronald Reagan. I don't know why they don't embrace this guy. I have my suspicions as to why they don't.
What's your suspicion?
Oh, well, they think he's too liberal.
Yeah, well, when he ran for governor, as I recall, in Massachusetts, he actually was pro gun control and pro gay rights and pro choice.
Yeah,
and then he willfully threw all those things overboard when he wanted to run for president.
Yeah, that's right. But there's, you know,
we could be the head of the American Conservative Union.
Party. They need to embrace that.
Well, Tom, you know, let's talk about the state of political journalism, something you write about a little bit. You've written about the Washington Post scandal.
Yes. Isn't that something?
And, you know, but what is, you know, and I think I want you to talk about that. But also, you know, you're in Washington now for many years and you follow politics closely and follow the news closely. You know, what's your assessment of the quality of political journalism in Washington specifically?
Well, there's no shortage of reporters here. There's in the neighborhood. I'm sitting out in my yard right now as I talk to you, and I live across the street from a Washington Post reporter, and catty corner to another one. She used to be at the Post and then moved to the Journal. And I bought my house from a guy that was one of the big reporters for the Washington Post down the block from us. Is one of the editors of National Review. I mean, they're everywhere in this town. So unlike, you know, your sort of cities in the hinterland, everything gets reported here, or there's a chance for everything to get reported here. But it's still amazing how many stories slip through the cracks. I don't want to, you know, complain in the way that conservatives do about there being a Washington mentality. You know how they always talk about how Washington, mm-hmm. we didn't change Washington, Washington changed us, and that sort of thing. But there is a consensus here in Washington, and I think the Washington Post really is the voice of that consensus. And they will often report stories. Do you remember that what I.F. Stone used to say about them? You never know where in the Washington Post you're going to find a page one story. You know, and there's something very true about that. There's so many wonderful and amazing and revealing stories that come up in this town that are very underreported here, or not examined here, or not thought about. And for example, the scandal at the Washington Post was one. There's, I don't know if you noticed this, but I'm sure you did notice it. You're like the one guy who would. I wrote about it in my column in the Wall Street Journal. There were almost no other newspaper columnists that wrote about it. They were all writing about Sarah Palin, the death of McNamara, this sort of thing. But nobody touched that subject. Now,
yeah.
Why not?
Sicilian Code.
Is that what it is? I couldn't figure it out. It seems so juicy to me and so obvious, you know.
No, I think that there are very few successful journalists who are going to be critical of other journalists for their conduct and something so fundamentally that challenges the legitimacy and integrity of the institution in such a fundamental way.
Yeah. Well,
that's a historical pattern, at least. There are just a few who will. Among them were like Dan Frumkin, and you saw what happened to him.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And but, you know, what's funny is that traditionally the Washington Post are the most zealous keepers of that sort of sense of professional integrity. Mm-hmm. You know, they're constantly excommunicating people who cross the line. And, you know, they are the policers of the consensus here in Washington anyway. And then to find that they have put themselves.
Yeah, maybe explain, if you would, what the crisis was
for some
of our listeners who might have missed the little coverage there was of it.
Okay. What happened was they sent out a flyer, and this is it's almost hard to believe as I recount it now, but it's true. They sent out a flyer. The Washington Post, the publisher of the Washington Post, her office, sent it. And by the way, she is the granddaughter of Katherine Graham. The newspaper, like many papers, it's owned by a family. And anyhow, she sent out a flyer. It is a sort of invitation to a series of dinners or salons that they were going to have at her house, and it gave the price tag on the flyer. And for this price, your company, and this was addressed to basically to companies, could get together with Post journalists and people from Congress and people from the administration. They said in the flyer. And, you know, it would be an off-the-record conversation. There would be no – it would not be adversarial in the way that journalism is always said to be adversarial. That would not be there. That would not be present. It would be, you know – and it sounded awfully a lot like the Washington Post willing to sell itself to people willing to pay the price to have their voices heard in Washington. And as you and I both know – I mean, that's how this city works. You know, the lobbying is kind of the fundamental operation, and whether it's a newspaper or whether it's a not-for-profit think tank, everybody is following this kind of model of you pay us and we'll get your message out. And now here's the Washington Post doing it. It's the most extraordinary thing.
Well, let's go to our phone lines now. If you want to join us and talk with Tom Frank, our guest today, the phone number at Media Matters is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to our first caller who's been waiting patiently. Line 4, Woodstock, Illinois. You're on the air with Tom Frank.
Good afternoon, and thank you for a great program. I had a question in regard to the national health care debate, and specifically, if your guest could explain the position of the large labor unions in this country. What positions are they staking out, or position, and what can we look forward to in terms of their role in the debate? Thank you.
Well, thank you, caller.
Well, I don't know the answer to that. You know, union by union, what their position is. I'm sorry. Do you know, Bob?
Well, I think you're right. I'm not sure exactly what the caller, if he had a specific issue. I think there's a split in the labor movement. I think but I think they're all largely in favor of health care reform.
I'm sure they are,
yeah.
But I wish I knew the answer to that. But I
well, let me just turn.
I should, but I don't.
Well, let's split it in half then. Let's talk about health care and labor separately. You know, health care seems to be the big issue now. The Obama administration plans to deliver on. And, you know, what's your sense of the plan that they're behind and how good it would be if it would solve the problem and what the prospects are for getting it passed?
Let's see. I think it's the plan is to set up a public health care system that would be a kind of a fallback system for people that can't afford the private sector insurance. I think it's it's a decent idea. It's a compromise, of course. It's not single payer. It's not the obvious answer to the problem. And everybody knows what the obvious answer to the problem is. And everybody also knows that the only reason we don't have that is because the power of the money of the insurance companies.
And Obama basically said that a couple of years ago when he started running. And then someone told him to stop mentioning that. He parked that line.
I have heard that from not just Obama. I mean, I've heard it from people who were extremely well placed during the last go round. You know, when Clinton was trying to get some kind of health care reform back in the early 90s, that it was stopped by the insurance companies. This is something that everyone knows here in D.C. Whether he'll now then. So Obama's got they've got this proposal. The right is fighting it on the grounds that. That it'll essentially nationalize all health care because it's silly. If on the one hand they say government can't ever do anything right, on the other hand, if government starts doing this, they'll drive all the private companies out of business, which is this very fundamental contradiction in their argument, but that's the way they like to play it. that's the thing about pro-business politics. There's all kinds of contradictions all the time in this stuff. And it never stops anyone. D.C. is a very interesting town, Bob. You and I came up in academia, where arguments were very important, and they were settled by reference to reality, truth.
Yeah, evidence.
Yeah, evidence. And it's just not that way here.
Well, Tom, one of the things that's coming up in the healthcare debate is the charge by Republicans that, this is a socialist plan, like you said, and that Obama is a socialist. And you don't have to go very deep into the conservative blogosphere or culture to find sort of a widespread conviction that the Democratic Party and Obama are socialist and Marxist.
Yeah.
This, knowing a little bit about socialism and Marxism and knowing a lot about Obama and the Democratic Party, this seems to me like weak on evidence.
Oh, of course it is. It's just rhetoric. It means nothing. I mean, you don't want to hear my personal history, but I've been red baited many times, and it's ridiculous. I never quote Marx. I do talk about social class. The thing that seems to bug people is that I talk about social class, and whenever you bring this up, people assume you're some kind of Marxist. They don't know about sociologists, mm-hmm. I suppose, the study of social class. But that's just so much empty rhetoric. People have no idea what socialism is, or even what communism is. It's ridiculous. You shouldn't waste your time even thinking about it. that's my opinion.
But what's interesting too, and this goes back to the healthcare debate, because I read somewhere of a legation, I think of Norwegians or Swedes, who recently were in the United States, and they were sort of asked about the healthcare debate, and these were actually conservative members of some conservative party, and they were astonished at how on just about every issue that's shared between their country and the United States, Obama and the Democrats, which are their right, and they were the conservative party. And, in healthcare, they all agreed in single payer. They believed in free higher education for all students.
Yeah.
Right up and down the list. And so then to have Obama called a socialist to these people was like, bewildering, to put it mildly.
Yeah. I think that's about right. That's a good way of putting it. What was I going to say about that? I'm sorry, it's slipped my mind already.
Well, the excitement of being on Media Matters has done that to many guests, Tom Frank.
So
let me reintroduce you to our listeners who might have just tuned in. Our guest today on Media Matters, Thomas Frank, the columnist, author of the Tilting Yard column every week in the Wall Street Journal, the author of several books, including The Wrecking Crew, which came out last year, which we discussed on the show when it came out, What's the Matter with Kansas, which is probably one of the biggest selling nonfiction books of political coverage of the last 10 years, and One Market Under God, a classic work on the exuberance, the irrational exuberance of the 1990s so-called new economy. If you'd like to call in with questions or comments for Tom Frank, the phone lines are open at 333-9455 or our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Tom, let's talk about something you raised earlier in the show that's one of my pet passions that I work on, which is what's happening with newspapers and journalism in the United States today. I remember a conversation you and I had, and I can't remember if it was on air or if it was just a private conversation we had 2 or 3 years ago, when you were talking about how you, for some research you were doing, maybe it was for the Kansas book, I can't remember which one, you went back and read a bunch of newspapers from the 60s, I think it was.
Yeah.
And you were struck at the richness and the quality of the coverage and just middle of the road, everyday daily newspapers in cities like Kansas City or Cleveland.
I know what you're talking about. I was researching Wichita in the late 80s and early 90s. They had the sort of conservative uprising there. And the Wichita Eagle, it's not a household name among newspapers, had very good coverage of it. But, of course, it wasn't on the Internet. To find it, I had to read the microfilm. And I was really surprised by how quality it was. And by the way, I was going to bring that up myself, because one of the stories that I recently wrote about in the journal, I found it in the Kansas City Star. It was some people who were accused, they're from Uzbekistan of all places, accused of running a labor trafficking ring in Kansas City. And they were trafficking, I think there's like 1,000 victims, alleged victims of this ring, which would make it the biggest labor trafficking case in the U.S. ever. And these are people that they lured here with, I think, H-2B visas, or that was the idea anyway. They brought them here, made them work, kept them in what's called debt bondage, or that's the charge anyway. And so they had these people virtually in a state of slavery, technically would be indentured servitude. And this story wasn't covered in any of the big national newspapers. I know I wrote about it in the Journal, but it wasn't. No one wrote about it at all, and it's a shocking story. And this is the sort of thing that we are used to reading about. And I did the research for the Wrecking Crew. I read a lot about the Saipan, an island, U.S. island out in the Western Pacific. And the reason it came up is because they hired Jack Abramoff as their lobbyist. So I got interested in them. And, of course, Jack Abramoff then got the entire conservative movement talking about how they were this laboratory of liberty. This was the great beacon of freedom in the Western Pacific. And what they were, in fact, doing was they had people they had immigrants in indentured servitude out there, paying them very, very, very little. And but this is not in the Western Pacific. This is right under our nose. This is in Kansas City, of all places. And the local newspaper there, the Kansas City Star, has been doing their best on this story, but it's they don't have a lot of resources anymore. Like all newspapers, they've hit hard times, and so what we know about the case comes largely from the federal prosecutor that brought the charges. It's a classic story, and it's a story both this horrible labor violation. This kind of thing that is it's coming home here. It's come to the heartland, and then at the same time, the demise of newspapers, which are finding it a difficult story to cover. Anyhow,
well, our guest
so that little ray of sunshine there.
Well, I want to get back to this issue, but we do have a caller who's waiting patiently. Again, our guest Tom Frank. If you want to call in, the lines are open at 333-9455 or toll free 1-800-222-9455. Let's now go back to the phone lines to a patient caller. Line 1, Champagne, you're on the air with Thomas Frank.
Okay, can you hear me okay?
I can hear you.
Yeah.
Okay, just a comment or a couple questions or comments. But I have seen almost nothing or very little in the mainstream print and have heard very little on the TV media on the Pope's recent, or stumble over this word, encyclical, which the BBC seemed to portray as a rather intense attack on capitalism. And I remember on his other encyclicals, I believe they've been covered fairly intensely in the mainstream media. Two, what do you make of, this is off on a tangent, what do you make of Newsweek's new format? I've got very mixed feelings on that, and I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Tom. I saw a little bit, but I have to agree with the caller. There wasn't a whole lot of coverage of the Pope's I don't know the technical language. I'm not practicing Catholic, but his comments on capitalism.
You've asked the wrong guy. It's just not my that's not my subject. Now maybe I should read up on that because the caller made it sound very interesting.
Yeah, I think it was there's always been that tradition for the last several decades, elements of the Catholic Church, even fairly far up the hierarchy, that have had a social justice component and been very critical of inequality and sort of the mindless consumerism and materialism and bankruptcy.
Well, it surprises me coming from this Pope, who I had sort of already written off as very conservative. But then again, what do I know about it, Bob? Not very much.
Yeah, again, this gets back to the issue we're talking about, the press coverage. I mean, this is a story basically that this fell through the cracks in North America.
Yeah. Well, I should look into it. That's a good idea. And about news, I don't read Newsweek. I'm very sorry to say. What was he referring to in the?
And again, here I am, the host of the known program
Media Matters,
and I confess I have not been. I saw Newsweek recently, and it had an interesting format, but I thought it was a special issue. I didn't realize that maybe it was. It was also a lot of people talking about what they read in the summer. It was sort of thing you'd usually get for a free weekly in Topeka. what your reading list so when you go to the beach is going to be.
Well, let me change the subject slightly. We were talking about the local newspaper in Wichita, Kansas, and you and I were looking at the sort of death of newspapers, coming very quickly. And I always used to think, I would go back to Wichita when I was promoting What's the Matter with Kansas. I go back there all the time, as a matter of fact. And that newspaper there has shrunk and shrunk and shrunk. And it's not anything like what it was in the late 80s and early 90s. I mean, it's not even close. It's filled with boilerplate reissue that they get from wire services. And I always wondered, when was a place like that going to become when I was a kid, it was a two-newspaper town. Hard to believe, city of 300,000, two newspapers. But when will it become a no-newspaper town? And strangely, papers like that seem to be—they're going to hang on. It's the big cities where you've got places like San Francisco, which are very quickly going, or soon it looks like they're going to become places with no newspapers. And I think that this is—no one has been more critical of newspapers than me. And I have a lot of objections to them and to the way that they've done their job. But at the same time, Bob, what is the world going to be like without them?
Yeah, and this is a question for you. I'd like to turn around and ask you, Tom Frank, because I know you're also a blogger. You blog for the Huffington Post.
Oh, right. Well, they put my columns on there.
Oh, well, we'll call you a blogger. Well, you're an honorary blogger. I mean, it seems that the explanation for what we're going to do with the decline of sort of commercial journalism, newspaper journalism, is going to either come from allowing these companies to sort of sell their stuff on the internet and set up a firewall or paywall or whatever they call it.
Yeah.
So you can't read anyone's stories unless you pay some fun money to them to bankroll the journalism. Or that we just let these big dinosaurs and newspapers go out of business and let people do their own thing on the internet with the blogosphere and with Twitter and YouTube and Wikipedia and all those tools. And the new technology will generate the sort of journalism we need organically over time.
Well, do you think that's really going to happen?
It's my show, Frank. I ask the questions.
Okay.
I'm asking you because I'd like to hear what you think.
I don't think that's going to happen. I think that's a leap of faith. I think like so many things, we expect it's like. And in a lot of ways, it's parallel to the kind of things that we expect of the market. We just expect, if the market thinks that we need these things, then the market will deliver these things. And I don't think that's ever been the case. Or if it is, if the market could do away with journalism, it certainly would. I don't think that these things will just appear organically. Maybe that's just because I'm a natural born pessimist, but you think of the resources that it takes to do a newspaper and the kind of professionalism, I mean, such as it is, that was required in the heyday of journalism to give us the product that we had. And also the years that it took to develop that model. You've read newspapers from the 19th century. They were. You can't trust anything they say.
Yeah, that's right. Well, our guest today, Tom Frank. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We have time for a couple more callers here at WILL. Let's go to the phone lines right now. Line 1, Champaign, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Thomas Frank.
Hello. I've found it to be sort of the height of irony that the Fox News Channel was celebrating the death of Walter Cronkite, whose hallmarks were objectivity and even-handedness, and that's the way it is. I thought Fox, of all people, should have been glad he was dying, if that, in fact, was his motif. But my question to you is, since I believe Fox appeals to a minority of a minority, why does Fox News Channel rank as the top cable news channel, and Bill O'Reilly rank always in the top 10 in terms of cable TV rankings?
And not only that, he writes every book he writes is golden. You know, the man is, I think that I've spent a lot of time thinking about Fox News. And you have to remember, first of all, that you're talking about a cable news channel. So for them to be ranked number one, you're talking about a relatively small marketplace, you know, as opposed to, say...
You know, and I must say, Tom, I think that while O'Reilly's been number one at times in his time slot, I don't think overall Fox has been the number one cable news channel in ratings, unless you're doing, like, over 65.
That may well be, but I think it is in some respects number one. But I'm not certain about that, Bob. But I do think that, you know, it's a successful enterprise.
Definitely.
And I think what happened. Who's the guy in charge over there? I forget his name.
Roger Ailes,
right?
Yeah.
And this is a man with long experience on the in Republican politics, long experience with the, you know, with right wing mentality. And I think that the man figured out something that you and I have talked about before, and that I've written about before, which is that the sort of what I've called, you know, backlash culture, you know, the sort of angry, what we called in the Gingrich years, angry white male culture. But what, you know, he goes back to Spiro Agnew, goes back to George Wallace. This is, you know, this is this strain of thought on the American right, that this is not just political. This has huge commercial potential. This is something that people really—it's a lot of fun. You think about something like Archie Bunker, you know, where people thought Archie—they didn't think Archie Bunker was a joke. They agreed with him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Roger Ailes or somebody else must have figured this out at some point. That this is not just, this shouldn't just be left up to politicians. That this is something where you can seriously drive some ratings with this stuff, and they got a guy like O'Reilly. By the way, and that's the other thing you have to remember about O'Reilly. I'm not a big fan of O'Reilly. In fact, you might say I really, really, really don't like Bill O'Reilly. But he is very good at what he does. You know, this kind of blustery bullying. You know, he is really, really good at it. And
who do you think would be better at blustering bullying, Limbaugh or O'Reilly, if it was a 15-round match?
Much better.
You
my
think
opinion.
So?
Yeah. But you know, what do I know? By the way, Limbaugh is from my neck of the woods. He comes from
Cape Girardeau,
Missouri, and his formative years were in Kansas City. He was a broadcaster for the Royals. And there's restaurants that I like to go to when I'm in Kansas City that have pictures of him on the wall because he used to hang out at these places in his Kansas City days.
You learn a lot of good, important things on Media Matters, and that was just one of them. Let's go back to the phone lines for our last caller for Tom Frank here on Media Matters. Let's go now to Line 4, Chicago. Yeah. Thank you for joining us. You're on the air with Tom Frank.
Yeah, talking about Rush Limbaugh, he was invited to go to New York by William Buckley, the Mr. Conservative himself, and participate in allowing him to develop his manner and style to become how he is represented today and become a tool of the the media juggling and manipulating forces that the Republican Noise Machine and all the other things that are being written to coerce and manipulate people's viewpoints. But I wanted to get back to the matter of you're working for the Wall Street Journal now, and you're not really into the economics, as you say, although your wife is. So, but the question is, as revealed by the recent report in Rolling Stones about the manipulation that's gone on in the markets, to the point where people are making profits on others' losses. You had things like Trump having been declared bankruptcy for many of his holdings, and he says, that's okay, we can work that out, and knowing the books and the rules and so forth, having him work in his favor, and then going back to Rockefeller when he declared a monopoly, says, well, we can break up our pieces and begin to wheel and deal for the good intentions of the legislatures that we can influence and the judges and so forth. So there's a whole area of spectrum that you could maybe comment on about needing more emphasis for the public to become enlightened on these matters. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. And Tom, you wrote a column not too long ago, if I'm not mistaken, on sort of captive regulatory agencies.
Yeah. This is something that I know a fair deal about. The caller should go back and read One Market Under God. That's a book I highly, highly recommend.
And being somewhat more objective than you as the author of that book, Tom, I highly recommend it too. And I just want to take a second while you compose your answer, Tom, in your mind, just to say for readers who have not read Tom's books, be it The Wrecking Crew, One Market Under God, What's the Matter with Kansas, or Conquest of Cool. These are not books you read like medicine. These are books you read like ice cream. They are such a pleasure to read. You're really a terrific writer.
Well, that's awfully nice of you, Bob.
True. I mean, when one of your books comes in, it's an immediate sit-down read cover to cover.
Well, I hope I can. I don't know. I don't know if I'll ever write another one. That's high praise. I'll never be able to live up to that.
Well, let me be the judge.
All right. Well, yes. The administration finally came out with a big report on what went wrong in the financial markets over the last couple of years that led to this crisis. This was published a month ago, and it's good as far as it goes. You know, it describes what was going on at the at the lenders and and the crazy stuff that was going on with the bond rating agencies, all these sort of things. What they completely left out of it, and what's one of the most interesting aspects, all that stuff, by the way, is very interesting. And last year especially, I wrote about it as it was happening. I wrote about it again and again and again because I was fascinated by the crisis, or by the collapse as it was happening. But looking back at it now, one of the main points, and this is, we never talk about it here in D.C., or I talk about it all the time, but here in D.C., the city never talks about it, and that is the idea of regulatory capture. Regulatory agencies that are essentially, that do the bidding of the industries they're supposed to be supervising, okay? And that sounds really sinister, but in fact it is very, very common. It's so common that, sociologists study it. It's a well-known phenomenon. Happens again and again and again, and in fact has happened since the very first regulatory agency ever. And it was, in some ways, and this was just to cut to the chase here, this was my theory in The Wrecking Crew was to take this idea of regulatory capture and apply it to politics generally. That is how the conservative movement here in Washington, that's how they function. They are a device of capture, not just regulatory agencies, but the government generally. And then I illustrated this with all sorts of stories of the different departments of the federal government that when they, these people get in charge, they essentially run these departments in reverse, Labor Department, Environmental Protection Agency, that sort of thing. And in housing, you saw this is especially bad, banking regulation.
Tom Frank, on that note,
talking too damn much?
Well, yeah, I think the band's tuning up the background. That means they want to clear me out of the studio. I want to thank you so much, Thomas Frank, for joining us today.
Okay. Anytime, Bob.
All right, I want to thank Kyle Kroha and Andrew Boyle and for working the board and producing the program. And I'd like to thank my wife, Inger Stoll, the last 23 years. Today's our anniversary, and every Sunday for the last 7 years, she's let me do this show. And bless her, and everyone have a great week. See you in 167 hours.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, today will be mostly cloudy with a high of 73 degrees. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low of 52. Monday, mostly sunny skies with a high of 78 degrees. Mostly clear Monday night with a low of 57. Tuesday, mostly sunny with a high of 82. And clouds move in Tuesday night with a low of 62. This is Illinois Public Media.